Oh, the green fields of Wall Street were blooming, unawares that a reckoning was looming. What with CDOs flowing and bonuses growing and bankers are selling the bait. Till September of 2008, oh, the price of me shares keeps a-falling, and the mountains of debt are a-calling, so you still do aspire next year to retire. Enough of your old caterwauling.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. Other books include When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Lowenstein.
Ian, it's very good to be on the show.
Just reading your book credits here, it sounds like you're a prophet of doom.
You know, Ian, that's occurred to me, and it wasn't by intent. In fact, after the previous book on pensions, I said to my editor, you know, I want to do something cheerier, or not one of these running financial crises books. And I just come back in the spring of '08 from a book tour. And she calls up and says, what do you think about Bear Stearns? And, it was obvious she wanted me to do a book on that. And I sort of pushed her off for a bit. And then it was, what do you think about Fannie and Freddie? And I sort of said, well, this thing will blow over, you know. But obviously it didn't. And I think she called again after Lehman failed and that terrible week in September. And so, yes, once again, I was a chronicler, if not a prophet of doom.
Well, I think for the sake of the audience, we should probably clarify, the end of Wall Street was about all of the above that you were finally sort of sucked back into writing about, because it was the story of the century, if you will, the near-death experience of the global economy.
I really think so. I'm glad you brought it up, because, the same way you may get a tremor, a series of tremors before the big quake, I think if we look back at the financial history that our generation has lived through, the Black Monday stock market crash, the junk bond, the SNL fiascos, the dot-com mania, and there are many others, we're living in an age of tremendous financial volatility, which is not unrelated to the financial freedoms and deregulations of the last couple of decades. And in particular, in the era of Alan Greenspan, the theory was propagated that anything goes, and anything that private bankers do, by the way, including whatever kind of mortgage you want to write, was fine. And I think this episode was this big quake was really the result of the culmination of that sort of speculation, an absolute laissez-faire approach.
So how do you explain, though, and obviously it's easy in retrospect, and even Alan Greenspan himself had to do a kind of conditional mea culpa, or somewhat like the piano player in the whorehouse.
That's right. But when he said it, it's sort of like the captain of the Titanic apologizing for hitting the iceberg. I mean, right. But I will credit, you're right. I mean, let's at least give Alan credit for saying he was wrong. We can't always trust markets, but go ahead.
I was going to say, how did he get to become the sage and the guru? I mean, he was the executive of Ayn Rand's estate, and how could a third-rate Hollywood writer become such a great economic prophet and have such a devoted disciple?
You may recall when Greenspan once said, "If I've been speaking clearly, you must have misunderstood me." But he cultivated this image of being the sage, of being mystical and indeed obscure. And I think it wasn't just his obscurity, he presided over a very happy and, for the most part, a buoyant economic age. And does the man make history, or history make the man? Were all of the central bankers in the 1970s so bad, or was the combination of you know, oil shocks and so on, did that just make it a, you know, a very tough era? I think he really rode the wave of you know, the wonderful economy we had in the 90s, the balanced budget that Clinton and the Republican Congress reached jointly in the 90s, and, you know, like the coach with great players, you know, he seemed to have this stardust.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. But is there something to all of these crashes that you've covered in your various books, culminating with this near-death experience for the global economy in the fall of 2008, in the sense that what seems to come out of it is that the insiders get more powerful, and, you know, now we're talking about these too big to fail banks being bigger than ever. I just spoke the other day to the former head of Commodities and Futures Trading Commission. It was about the price of oil and the price of food, which are going up precipitously, and asked about the extent to which Wall Street is gaming. And something like $40 billion is being placed through these Wall Street bookies on whether oil will go up. And of course, that's driving up oil, as we know from the fall of 2008, when it got up to $147 a barrel. So there is there's something about this that, to me, feels sort of un-American, that the poor guy at the pump, the working stiff and the middle class overworked person, American, has to be gouged in order for people to speculate. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't think Wall Street has control over what happens to the price of oil or the price of real estate, for that matter. Otherwise, you know, neither one of them would have crashed. You know, oil is now going through a cycle and a half because it's back up, right? But I do think that there's way too much trading and gaming going on. That, you know, the point of trading is to have a little bit of liquidity in the market, so that when real producers of oil and real refiners and, you know, real users, so that they have a market to unload their wares, so that the rest of us, we can go to the pump and there'll be gasoline there. But when you get a market that is overwhelmed in either direction, by the way, up or down, by people speculating on which direction oil prices are going, yes, I think that the tail's wagging the dog. Firms like Goldman Sachs used to be primarily in the business of raising capital, which was a useful function for society. If you were starting a business or you were expanding a business, you went to Goldman and you know, they floated shares or debt or whatever, and you could expand the business. 90% of Goldman's revenues now are entirely to do with trading, you know, which is just a zero-sum game. Goldman wins and someone loses, or someone wins and Goldman loses. And when too many traders pile up on one side or another, yes, it will distort the prices of the, you know, of the underlying asset for real people. I'm not, you know, we have all this trading in mortgage securities, which obviously, you know, greatly impacted, you know, the country in 2008. Before we had mortgage securities, we did not have a housing shortage. I mean, the fundamental purpose of the housing market, which is to provide shelter to Americans or whatever country, was being met. And I agree with you that the market was greatly destabilized to no particular productive end by the creation of all of these betting securities, particularly derivatives, which raise no money, which funnel no money into productive purposes, but are only are really casinos, big bets, where one party's betting A and one party's betting A.
Well, I think it's reached a point of kind of surreality, if you will, Roger Lowenstein, given that the big brokerage houses like Goldman Sachs apparently have moved their computers as close as possible to the New York Stock Exchange computer, so that they have the advantage of the speed of light.
That's right, because if there are this flash trading, which actually, you know, precipitated that that crash of about a year ago, when the market fell, 1,000 points or something in a minute, and then immediately went back, something, you know, completely bizarre. This is all done by computers who trade in and out of stocks in less than a second, so that it becomes important for Goldman and anyone else traveling at the speed of light to not be physically too far This is absolutely absurd. There is no social purpose whatsoever served by people, by computers trading in and out. The function of the stock market is to allow buyers and sellers to analyze securities so that they can price them accurately, so that through the pricing mechanism, capital is allocated in the proportion that society needs to housing and steel and airplanes and software and so on. I just don't think computers, who are buying and selling in less than a second, are fulfilling that role. And you know, I mean, that's something that I would outlaw. I just would.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. So your book, the recent one, and the earlier books and the work that you've done with your decade with The Wall Street Journal and now with The New York Times and Smart Money, how about sort of some reflection on the state of American capitalism? Just the weight of what you're telling me makes me wonder whether I thought that capitalism was not supposed to be about extracting wealth, but about creating wealth. And much of what we're talking about is simply about extracting wealth.
Let me join those two ideas. You know, Winston Churchill's line that democracy is the worst system ever invented, except for any other that's been tried. I mean, I think that's still true for capitalism vis-a-vis, you know, other economic systems. The idea of capitalism, to get to your point about extraction, wealth extraction or wealth creation, it's supposed to be the creation of it that enables people to extract it. If Bill Gates creates a successful firm, Microsoft, he's going to get rich, and, you know, and he did. And on the other hand, if someone creates a firm that fails, they shouldn't get rich. And that link, you know, A, provides a sense of fairness to the rest of us, and two, it sends the right incentive. It means that the future Bill Gates of the world want to make sure their firms succeed. And what's happened, I think particularly in America, has been a severing of that link. Boards of directors have become so generous is too weak a word, just in an unseemly way, doling out these huge bonuses, regardless of how people how the firms do. I looked at compensation of Larry Ellison recently, and he made $70 million this year, $85 million the year before, $85 million the year before that. By the way, the stock is up about 1% a year over 10 years. I mean, that is a gross perversion. It's you know, he to me is less a true capitalist than he is a socialist taxing his shareholders regardless of his performance. And so we have a real problem at the board level, and I think a real problem in terms of the shareholders' right to determine pay and to determine who their representatives on the board will be. We also have an incentive problem beneath the level of the CEO. If you think about the traders at Merrill Lynch in this episode, and Lehman and the other firms, they were getting big bonuses for the amount of trades, the size of the trades they put on. Years later, if those trades went bad and the firms went downhill, the traders, well, they'd already pocketed their bonuses. You know, that is absolutely crazy. I mean, when you can't pay for someone for work that is going to end up in bankrupting their firm. Mm-hmm. So it's this disconnect between wealth extraction and true wealth creation. And wealth creation doesn't mean that you get the stock to go up for an hour and a half. It means that you've created an enduring enterprise which is going to generate profits, you know, for a long time that will pay employees and contribute taxes to society and the rest. And I think that's what we need to reestablish.
And of course, now there's an extra casino going on here with you mentioned the high tech. Facebook, of course, is still private, and it did a deal with Goldman Sachs to satisfy the insiders. So the average investor is not even in the game anymore. I mean, don't you think? I've only got a couple of seconds left here, but I don't mean to monopolize your time.
Well, you know, Facebook is a tricky one because I'm not prepared to say that it's worth $50 billion. You know, Ian, I'm not prepared to say that it's not. I don't use Facebook. I'm the wrong generation, but an awful lot of people do. I think the the problem, whether it's in high tech or elsewhere, is that when people are paid off for short-term performance or short-term deals or short-term stock prices, or they write a mortgage and immediately flip it, so they're paid just for writing the mortgage and not for whether the mortgage is any good, it, up and down the line, it creates the wrong incentives. And by the way, this extended to the individual borrower because, you know, they went out and took out maybe an option ARM mortgage that was a $200 a month payment. It jumped up to, in some cases, $600, $700 a month, and that person just said, well, I'll refinance. I don't have to worry about it. They were also just watching the short term. And, you know, when everybody's watching the short term and thinking they can get out, they'll sell the bad security. When the music stops, not everybody can get out at once. So I you know, if there's an endemic cultural problem to Wall Street and American capitalism, that short-term focus goes a long way towards explaining it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Roger Lowenstein.
Ian, a real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Lowenstein, who's the author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You may hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I've also started a daily blog there. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog and let me know what you think. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.